Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show. Joining us, as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm, at AH Malcolm on Twitter. And of course, one of the great VIP writers over at RedState.com, our sister site, as well as occasionally puts stuff outside the paywall. And he has one of his Malcolm's memories, the day Bill Buckley asked my help in Small Town Etiquette. And that's open to everybody. You can go over there and read that yourself. And Andrew, first off, happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Thank you very much. I hope everyone had a good time. I certainly did.
I did as well.
It's my favorite holiday.
And you get two of them. We talked about that last week.
That's right.
You Canadian, you.
We celebrate. We celebrate two, and then get roast beef on Christmas. So it works.
There you go, roast beef. But you do turkey twice. Do you do turkey for both of them, or?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, but I don't know if we can afford the roast beef this year, but we'll try.
Well, you know, actually, you know, the price went down this year. I saw this, I think it was like $3, went down from $58 to $55 for the average Thanksgiving meal for four and all that kind of stuff.
The average Thanksgiving meal, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking about roast beef.
Oh, no, I have no idea where roast beef's going to be. We're going to do ham this year for Christmas. So, we did. I did the turkey on the smoker, and it turned out good. I've got a pretty good recipe for that.
And you served it in the hot tub?
I did not serve it in the hot tub. No, we didn't have the top hot tub operating. That would be weird, actually. And look, I like weird.
But you don't have to clean the table then.
No, but then you got to clean the spa, and that's a whole lot more.
Yeah,
that's a whole lot more complicated.
Anyway, so here we are with the coming up on the holiday interim when things are supposed to be slower.
Well, we got an election tomorrow. As we're talking about it, it'll be today. It'll post up. You know, this is going to post on Tuesday, but it's Monday as we're recording this. There's an election in Tennessee to replace Mark Green. And did you see Donald Trump's Truth Social on this?
No.
He's telling everybody you got to turn out and vote for Matt Van Epps. He's the Republican nominee for this. Because Afton Ben hates Christianity and country music.
Oh my gosh!
Well, that
should be a candidacy killer here in Tennessee.
Well, you'd think in Tennessee, right? This is not far from, I don't know how far it is from where you live, but same state. And this is the woman who got up and talked about a few years ago about how much she hated Nashville and country music and pedal pubs. And look, I mean, I get Nashville. I might even get country music, but pedal pubs? I don't understand how you can hate pedal pubs. And that's not just Nashville either. There was a fun pedal pub thing going in St. Paul, Minnesota back in the day too when we were there. We did it once.
I'm ignorant. What is a pedal pub?
So it's I don't even know how you describe this thing. It's a bar. It's a rolling bar, right? And it's powered by people pedaling. So if you're at the bar, you're pedaling while you're drinking. So think of it like, you know, like a, I don't know, like a 14-person bicycle, I guess you could say. But you go up and down the street with this thing. So you get your exercise while you're getting a buzz. Generally speaking, so you got to get over to Nashville. Yeah, you have to work hard for your beer on a pedal pub. I will say that you have to work hard.
You could argue you're working off the calories, right? But
that's
the
argument.
Maybe I'll pass on that one. But yeah, anyway, Nashville is neat. I like Nashville.
Nashville's nice, but I mean, Afton Ben has this whole series of things that she, you know, they got video of her from in 2019 being dragged out of Governor Bill Lee's office screaming. She had gone in there to protest something and they called security or police. I don't know if it was security or police or maybe it was, Capitol Police for Tennessee. And there's video of her being dragged out of Bill Lee's office. And, you know, Bill Lee is not exactly Donald Trump. He's actually a pretty mild-mannered guy.
Yeah, he is. He is very popular. Yeah.
Yeah. And yet, Andrew, I don't know how this is, but Emerson, I mean, this just one poll, and it's tricky to poll in a special election, but Emerson had been within 2 points of Matt Van Epsen in an R plus 10 district. This is a district that Trump won by 22 points last year. Mark Green won it by about the same amount of points, 21 and a half points. Yeah. I mean, this is crazy. Special elections are crazy.
They are. And there seems to be a creeping mood of unhappiness in the country. And so anybody who's running is a target. I was reading in the Washington Times had a piece today that 78 mayors were elected this year, and half of them were Muslim, including,
wow, that's interesting,
including New York. That's, well, it's personally disturbing. I don't know any of them except the New York one and politically, but it's not the politicians. It's not a political cadre that appreciates tolerance.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, I think, like, I kind of hope that there's enough of a turnout tomorrow. The big deal is that Democrats got ahead, you know, got a jump start on early voting, as they have been doing. Republicans seem to be slow out of the gate with their Oppo research. They had some real bombs on Oppo research. Democrats were running the Jeffrey Epstein message, which kind of had its knees cut out from underneath it. Not too long before early voting ended, when Donald Trump flipped positions and said that he wanted them to pass the discharge petition because it was going to pass anyway, proved that the Epstein files were basically a nothing burger. But they were running hard on the Epstein files. They were saying, Matt Van Epps is going to help out Trump and keep the Epstein files locked up. And
yeah, it's a bad word. if you don't pay close attention to the news, it's a bad word. If you do, I mean, he's a bad guy, but the alleged association with him is not helpful.
Yep. Yep. And so what they're going to need tomorrow, because there was 84,000 ballots cast early voting, and it's going to favor Democrats probably substantially. So they're going to need to get a big turnout, which is the reason why Donald Trump was on Truth Social talking about. I should look up the actual quote, because it's actually, you know, it's very Trumpian, right? When you get Trump on Truth Social, you know what you're going to get, it's rarely going to be, he's also talking about, just now he's talking about, Tim Walz and, all the scandals that are coming out of there. But earlier today, and I'm going to scroll down till I get to this, to the great people of Tennessee's 7th district who gave me record setting wins in each of the three elections, I'm asking you to get out and vote for Matt Van Epps. He'll be a great congressman, and unlike his opponent, he cherishes Christianity and country music. She hates them both. This is a very pivotal election. The whole world is watching Make America Great Again. But I mean, this is part of what she said, right? In that video from a few years back, she was also talking about how she supported the burning down of police stations. This is in 2020 when, you know, the police station burned down in Minneapolis, and how, you know, you have to disband the Nashville Metropolitan Police Department. I mean, crazy stuff that she hasn't walked back. And did we talk about this last week? This was like the dumbest interview ever. So she was on M Snow, which is what I'm calling MS now. I'm calling it M Snow because it's very white. They're all about civil rights, but it's very white on M Snow. And she was on a panel show, and this is a couple of weeks ago, And I don't know who it was that she was talking with. The video is there. I don't know the identity of the person that she was talking with. But the woman is trying to give her an opportunity. She's throwing softballs up there so that Ben can distance herself from her previous remarks, right? And she's saying, yeah. Well, you know, in 2020, you know, you were saying, you know, defund the police and this and that. But, you know, a few years later now, you know, maybe you can put that into context for us. And she was... And she just refused to answer. She says, I didn't come here to get caught up in cable news talking points. And she was on a cable news show.
She said this. Yeah, that's not too savvy.
Why are you here? And the person is desperately kept trying to tee it up for her. And she just refused to swing, right? She wouldn't answer. She kept coming up with these, you know, word salads. And it was, she's so bad at it. And she might still win. This is the thing that kills me. She might still win.
Yeah. We've got some real turkeys in Congress now. And the overwhelming number of them are not Republicans.
No, true. A few of them are. But mostly they're not. So, yes, I mean, so this is it's going to be interesting to see if Republicans can actually pull this out in an R plus 10 district. Special elections are different. I get it. But look, if they lose this after everything else that's gone on over the last few weeks, it's not going to look good.
The media will have a field day with how this is ominous for Trump and for Republicans next year in the midterm. It may be, but what is it? Let's see, it's 40 weeks out. There's so much that can happen in the meantime.
47 weeks, I think, or 46 weeks, 48 weeks. Maybe it's 48 weeks. Yeah, until the midterms. Yeah, lots of stuff can happen. Nobody's really going to remember this, but, you know, the problem is for Republicans is that Marjorie Taylor Greene's resignation makes this really a necessary hold for them, because otherwise their margin is going to be down to one seat or zero seats for 4 months or so until Georgia can hold a special election to replace Greene. And so it got more important. I mean, it was already important. It wasn't that it was unimportant, but it got more important. And I think that that's what got Trump finally personally involved in this, because he hadn't done much in this special election.
Yeah. He's as I understand it, he's played a more active role in selecting at least the Senate candidates for next year's elections. He was kind of hands off in 2018, but it's good that he's getting involved for activating Republicans who tend to punt on the midterm, Republican voters who tend to punt on the midterm activity. Of course, more active Trump also activates the anti-Trumpers. So I guess it's a mixed bag.
I think it is a mixed bag. We'll see. We'll see when the, you know, tonight, as this gets posted, what the election results are going to be. But Donald Trump's obviously trying to generate some election day turnout. That's really, in the Emerson poll.
I hope a lot of people in the 7th district read Truth Social. I'm not sure they do, but I hope they do.
I'm not sure they do either. All right, let's talk about your column about Bill Buckley, because this is and not just Bill Buckley, but Hubert Humphrey. It's the same story, and it's really kind of touching. And, you know, Bill Buckley, you know, he's a conservative stalwart, but he was a guy who appreciated, I think, the old approach terms of relationships.
The Reagan Tip O'Neill approach to politics. Very, very civil, elegant, intellectual man. I, of course, had watched him on Firing Line, your show, and I put a link in there to people that want to catch up and see it. But I was the Tokyo bureau chief for a newspaper in Tokyo, which makes sense since I was the Tokyo bureau chief, I guess. But the phone rang on a Sunday afternoon, and I answered in, and it was a very familiar voice that I said to myself, "Oh, it can't be the voice," but it was. It was Bill Buckley, and he said, "Mr. Malcolm, this is Bill Buckley." And I said, "You know, if I hadn't recognized the voice, I might have said, yeah, really, who is this really pranking me?" But it was him, and he was in Tokyo, and he wondered if I might drop by. He knew it was last minute, but if I might drop by his hotel for dinner with him that evening. And I said, I thought I might squeeze that into my impossible schedule. I mean, how often does that happen? Poof, Bill Buckley calling me up. So I did, and it was the most charming dinner, man. And he had written a story for the Sunday magazine of my newspaper. And there's more details to this in the post yesterday on Sunday. But he wondered if I might take a look at an article that he had written for our Sunday magazine. Bill Buckley asking me to help him out with his writing. Okay, well, I said, yeah, sure.
I'll try to help you out. You said, "I'll try to help you out, Bill." I know you're struggling. You're just getting a start on this, but I'll try to give you a little boost.
Yeah, right. I mean, the whole thing was surreal, but he was the most charming, engaged dinner companion. I mean, just a prince, and it came across as so genuine and authentic. Anyway, so he read, or so he gave me the, it wasn't a printout in those days, it was a Xerox, and so I read it, and it was a wonderful story about a transatlantic flight from New York to London, and the movie projector broke, and the stewardess asked Buckley if he'd take a look and maybe he could figure it out. And he said he stood on a seat and looked into the projector department. And he knew it was hopeless. He knew nothing about movie projectors. So he realized, no, this is, you know, he checked the plugs and all that. But it wasn't that. And suddenly he heard a voice, a very familiar voice to him, saying, "Bill, what are you doing? Get out of there. Let me in there. Fix it." And it was Hubert Humphrey, who was also on the flight. He was dying of bladder cancer at the time. And of course, Humphrey thought that government and senators could fix anything. So Buckley stepped down and gave him the chair to stand on. And the stewardess whispered to Buckley, "The pilot is a big fan of Firing Line. And he wondered if you'd like to watch the landing from the cockpit."
Yeah,
who wouldn't, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So Buckley goes up to the cockpit of the plane, and he said it was a magical view. He's sitting right behind the pilot, and here's this, I guess in those days it was set 747, coming down, and below were the lights of this ancient city of London, glowing through thin clouds. And wow. it was just a beautiful view. And he was remarking on it when the cockpit door burst open, and it's Hubert Humphrey again. He said, "Bella, what are you doing in here? What's going on? Oh my gosh, look at that." And And so Buckley ended up watching the landing, of course, but watching Hubert Humphrey watch the landing of a 747 while Hubert Humphrey himself was coming in for a final landing in his own life. It was a beautiful little story. And I told Buckley that. You know, I said, you need to fix some words here and there. No, I didn't say that.
I was kind of wondering if you took the blue pencil out.
Right. You need to tighten this up. Get some more active verbs in here, Bill. Geez, I thought you were a writer. Anyway, it was a very touching story. But it was one of those little moments in life. Well, in my journalism, six decades of journalism, that I just wanted to share. This is the 37th in the series of memories over there, all of them outside the paywall, and a collection of things that happened to me, famous people I met, and moments that touched me or that were interesting from kind of behind the scenes, going to the Johnny Carson show and standing behind the curtain and several times, and going out with a rural mailman at Christmas time, 120 mile route for 14 customers, had a lot of it's a lot of fun, and judging by the page views, it's a very popular feature. It wasn't my idea. Jennifer Van Laar, the editor, remarked on some of the stories that I had shared with her in person, and she said, geez, you should write these. And I hadn't thought of it. I thought, who would care? But it turns out it does, and it's really kind of fun to savor
absolutely
some of those experiences. Some in journalism are not. Some experiences in journalism are not all that pleasant, or
some things are best left unsaid about journalism. Is that what you're saying?
yeah, fondly remembered. But I have to say, this was another era where it was not politically involved. I did write some politics, but it was straight, and in those days, it was generally pretty straight coverage. Of course, that's changed. You and I have talked about that after Watergate changed. But
the incentives changed, though, right? I mean, that was really what changed. The incentives changed. I think everybody got it in their heads that I think there's more to it than this. But I think one of the things that drove the changes in journalism is that people saw Woodward and Bernstein become stars, whether or not they entirely deserved that is another, that's up for history, debate that in history, but saw them become stars and said, that's what I want. I want that. I don't necessarily want to become an ink stained wretch who just merely, reports the data so that history can judge on its own. Right. I want to take down a president. I want to be a star, sort of thing.
Watergate, of course, was a legitimate story.
Absolutely.
But the next generation or second next generation of young journalists twisted it into fixing society. And that's how it got distorted into fixing society, and that is, you don't have to tell the truth or all the truth. You can twist it to fit the narrative that you want. And at the same time, you and I have talked about this, at the same time, journalism was rightly coming under pressure for, it wasn't DEI, but because it was largely white males, often from New England, white college-educated males, and it didn't have significant numbers of women in the business as reporters and editors, and blacks and so on. And so journalism with that kind of pressure and some court suits, wanted to correct the situation quickly, and they moved along young people who did not need to go through the apprenticeship that I did, where you learn the values of the institution, the idea of objectivity, and so on. They just basically, after a month or two, threw them into the business. And so they went in with the mind that we have to fix society. And they ended up like Janet Cook on the Washington Post making up stories, or Jason Blair on the New York Times making up interviews with Jessica, what's her name? And it's faking datelines that they were there when they in some place writing, interviewing when they weren't. It's been too bad. And as I said before, I don't think journalism can ever, unfortunately, mainstream can never recover its full credibility. It needs to work at it, but that's why the pressures of alternate journalism, like Hot Air and Red State and others, is good at forcing change and reform, which it's coming pretty slow. But there are signs at the LA Times and the Washington Post that things are beginning to change, CBS, that things are beginning to change.
Well, I think there's a recognition that things need to change.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm curious. I mean, the way that you describe the post-Watergate journalists, the next generation of journalists, and again, this is not the complete story. There's other factors that are involved in going from being at least somewhat connected to gumshoe reporting to just being narrative minding. I see that in the same way I see people who have adopted sort of these fringe movements as new civil rights movements. I think that there are people that really look back on the actual civil rights movement, which was very necessary, to overcome actual government discrimination, right? Explicit government discrimination. And I think that there's a certain amount of envy that they didn't get in on that. And so they're looking for ways to sort of create these, similar situations out of things that aren't actually an issue. And I see this, it has become sort of a cult. And I think it's the same sort of thing. That's maybe more writ large, if you will, on left-wing activism. Is that they're really still they have an envy that they weren't around for the actual civil rights movement. They've been trying to create one to satisfy their urge for meaning, because they grew up hearing basically that this was the ultimate meaning in political action. Absolutely. And rather than just simply be focused, I guess you could say, on actual liberty, actual equality of access, right? They're still looking for the next revolution, and this is maybe getting a little deeper than I wanted to get, but they're basically looking for the next revolution because they missed out on the one before.
And
well, I remember that's what you're getting at.
And Joe Biden wanted to associate himself with the civil rights movement.
Oh God, yeah, jeez, boy, that guy. There are certain people. There are certain people whose credibility is so low that when they say good morning, you have to look out the window just to be sure.
That was a sad era. It'll be interesting to see how the Biden, I call it like the Biden diorama, like a museum diorama, how that gets twisted in history, or perhaps gets revealed. But the Democrats and the left have not faced up to their conspiracy in prolonging those four painful years, and lying about it and trying to, I mean, can you imagine if they had succeeded in getting him another 4-year term?
Yeah,
I mean, that guy would be a vegetable by now.
And kind of is. You hardly ever see him in public.
No, yeah. Fortunately, I don't mind not seeing him. But now that he's fighting prostate cancer, and so then would more responsibility would likely follow on Ms. Harris. So we dodged a real bullet in that.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
but anyway, Andrew's, memories are fun.
The memories are great. Again, the day Bill Buckley asked my help and small town etiquette. So be sure to check that out.
Just that headline is so funny to me. It's just Bill Buckley.
Bill Buckley came to me and said, make me a better writer, please.
That's right. Andrew, could you help me? Yes, I founded the Modern Conservative Movement and I'm an icon, but I need your help.
You know, I haven't actually talked about my memory. I have not yet talked about my memory of when Donald Trump asked for my help to win an election.
Is that right?
Because, yeah, it's true. I got a phone call from Donald Trump saying, I need your help to win this election. It was recorded. And it went out to about, went out to about 10 million people, probably more like 100 million people. But Donald Trump called me and asked my help.
Telephone pranks are fun. This is off the subject, but when I was the executive assistant for the governor of Montana, I had him record the message on my home phone answering machine. And my wife didn't appreciate it because we got dozens and dozens of calls from people who didn't believe it. And, you know, they didn't want to talk to us. They just wanted to hear the message. He said, hello. It was a very familiar voice, like Bill Buckley, at least familiar in Montana. This is Governor Mark Roscoe. Andrew and Connie can't come to the phone right now, but they asked me to jot down any messages you might have. I mean, we had to do several takes because he was chuckling as he said it. It was just so much fun. Actually, there was some news coverage of it. It was fun, you know, and it made him normal. So anyway, telephone pranks are wonderful.
Well, with that, we come to the jokes of the week, by the way.
So I've got one too.
I have one for you. I'm going to let you go first, though.
Okay, mine is an old one from Jimmy Fallon. He said, Pete Buttigieg is now leading the polls in Iowa. Pete's very proud. He's been walking around like he's 5 feet tall.
All right. I got one for you from jokesoftheday.net. It doesn't have anything to do with Donald Trump asking my advice, by the way. So just, you know.
FYI. Okay. Well.
All right. So this older man is having hearing problems. His family finally sends him to the hearing doctor. So he goes to the doctor and the doctor tests him out and gets him a set of hearing aids. And the gentleman is amazed at how well he can hear. So a couple months goes by and he goes back to make sure that, you know, make for another adjustment, make sure the hearing aids are working for him. The doctor says, well, how are they working out for you? He says, oh, it's working great. I can hear everything now. He says, I had no idea how much I was missing. And the doctor says, well, your family must be really happy about this. He says, oh, I haven't told my family. I just sit around and listen to the conversations. I've changed my will 3 times. Changed my will 3 times. There you go.
You know, there is a story. Where was, I don't remember. I saw it online somewhere where, the guy says, you know, my family said I had a hearing problem. So they sent me to the audiologist and I went there and the doctor said, well, you really do need to get some help. But I don't think I'm going to do it because who needs a hearing aid? A hearing egg.
Oh, a herring egg.
So,
well, have I told you what happened the first time I went to the audiologist? This is just a few years ago. I was still living in Minnesota, but I think it was not long before we moved here. And I just decided that I wanted to get a baseline. I think it's like six or 7 years ago. It was 55 or 56. And I just wanted to get a baseline because in case I start having problems, I want to have a baseline for when I was doing exactly. Okay. So I call up for an appointment. I get an appointment. I go in. The receptionist says, "What brings you here today?" And I said, "I just really want to get a baseline. I don't think I have any issues." She looks at me. She says, "Did your wife send you here?" And I said, "Well, I mean, she didn't exactly send me here, but she was in favor of it. Let's just say that." So I get in with the technician, and the technician asked me the same question. And I said, "You know, I just want to get a baseline." And the technician, and I'm not kidding around now, this is not a joke. This is what actually happened to me. The technician says, "Did your wife send you here?" And I'm laughing. And I said, "Well, people keep asking me that, but, you know, not really, but, you know, she's in favor of this." So they do the audio session. Then the nurse comes in to take a look at, and she asks me, what brought you here? And I said, "I just want to get a baseline." And she says, "Did your wife send you here?" And I'm like, now I'm really laughing because I think this is freaking hilarious. And I said, "No, but apparently a lot of people must be sent by their wives here." She says, "You have no idea." The doctor comes in to go over the results, and he asked me the same question. No. I said the same thing, and he goes, "Did your wife send you here?" I said, how many people's wives send them here? He says, "Well, basically every one of them." And we're all laughing, right? Because I'm laughing. I think this is hilarious. I said, "I just really wanted to get a baseline for myself." And he says, Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right.
He says, "Well, there's," and then he says, "Well, with that in mind, I've kind of got good news and bad news for you." He said, "Well, what's the bad news?" He says, "Well, it's the same as the good news. Your hearing is excellent. You're gonna have to go home and tell your wife that."
Yeah.
I mean, I had a great time.
He said, "I need a herring egg." Yeah.
I should have said I need a herring egg. Yeah, I should have said I need a herring egg. But I mean, and we all had a great time with it,
that's a good story. I like that one. That's better than your joke. Yeah.
Well, I mean, anyway. You know, it kind of follows on from the joke. Yeah. And I have changed my will 3 times just to, you know. All right. Andrew Malcolm, the prince of Twitter, the regent of redstate.com. We'll be back again next week to do another one of these podcasts. And to catch up on all the different topics. And Andrew, great column. Thanks so much for sharing that with us today. Can't wait to talk next week.
Yep. Thank you, Ed. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you then.